Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Most Oregonians are probably aware that this next Monday, May 11th, is the much-vaunted Day of Discovery, the date in 1792 that the Boston ship captain, Robert Gray, crossed the notorious River Bar, now known as the Graveyard of the Pacific, and sailed into the wide river he named after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, which translates as Columbus Revived, a fittingly ironic name for the Great River of the West, honoring the hapless yet immortal ocean explorer who bumped into the Western Hemisphere 300 years earlier, seeking a straight nautical passage to the Asian East. But few Oregonians would recognize the same date as also Bloody Monday, which this May 11th is its 50th anniversary, a relatively obscure occurrence in a much larger national protest against the Vietnam War in 1970. They might remember, however, the Vortex Rock Festival that summer, also known as the Governor's Rock Festival, for Tom McCall, who pioneered the idea of a state-sanctioned countercultural debauch, the real purpose of which was to divert a possible bloody clash at the People's Army Jamboree. It has been half a century and a bifurcation of two millennia since Bloody Monday, when the city of Portland became a battlefield of a war against a war, and the spectacle of police crashing against anti-war protesters like a Civil War charge. The battlefield, as were so many clashes of that particular Civil War, was a college campus, Portland State University, which was next to a series of urban park blocks that run down the center of the city's southwest side. The number of persons crowded into that urban campus space on that sultry, cloudy spring afternoon outside PSU's tall buildings seemed 1,000 at least, shouting, chanting, and screaming as the police, armed with long wood clubs, formed up to charge the relatively few who stayed to resist them, about 100, after the larger crowd sought safer ground, removing their persons but not their voices. Behind the linked armed defenders rose the object of their resistance, a plasticized geodesic dome that had acted as an ersatz hospital for anti-war protesters and local street people during a week of dissent against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. The hospital, which was staffed by local volunteer doctors, nurses, and medics, had become the focal point for violence. Barricades to block traffic from street on either side of the park blocks were built of found objects that included park benches, chicken wire, and wood looted from a few nearby houses being deconstructed for a future office building or parking lot. For nearly a week, the barricades housed the demonstrators, and the university has shut down for the duration of the protest. The Portland State demonstration was part of a nationwide shutdown of colleges and universities in protest of the Vietnam War and the latest iniquity, the Cambodian incursion. The national protest was dubbed Woodstock Nation from the Rock Festival in upstate New York the previous August. A few days earlier, on May 4th, four white students had been shot and killed and 10 others wounded at Kent State College by Ohio National Guardsmen, and a few days after that, two black students were killed by police at Jackson State, Mississippi. The police who attacked at Portland State were the city's tactical squad, who were also the urban motorcycle police, as well as riot control platoon. Initially organized to contain black insurrection, the attack on May 11th against predominantly white college students was their first official foray. A veteran police captain who sympathized with the students attempted to forestall the assault and ordered that the hospital dome, quote unquote, stay up. The captain was overruled by a deputy chief, who in turn was part of a confusion of directives. The students and allied dissenters were told by the City Parks Bureau that the hospital dome was not to be disturbed, bad media to demolish a hospital, however ersatz and amateur. But the SWAT cops had contrary orders and violently carried them out, charging the semicircle of protectors like a tsunami. As they charged online, their clubs pointed like guns at the unarmed hospital defenders. The cops chanted a karate mantra of oos, oos, oos. The attacked pacifists simultaneously shouted, peace, peace, peace. The cries compressed into a frenzied roar, and pandemonium ensued. The cops literally ran amok. The hospital dome was pummeled and torn apart by clubs that also beat upon heads and bodies. Most of the defenders were pushed back, screaming in pain and profanities, throwing pieces of the hospital's rubble at cops who struck at them with their clubs. Volunteer medics made rushes into the melee to get injured people to safety. City ambulances came through, sirens shrieking. Each was filled with as many as would fit and raced away to hospitals. It was a risk sending the injured to hospitals and possible arrest, but little else was possible. Too many people, women and men, girls and boys, were hurt attempting to save the demolished hospital. Despite the rabid fury of the attacking cops, no one was beaten to death. The cops retreated afterward to buses in the college parking lot, nearly surrounded by angry demonstrators who had escaped injury. And for at least those last few minutes, the cops seemed scared. For a number of years afterward, wreaths of flowers were placed each May 11th where the ersatz hospital had been. Sometimes rallies were held in commemoration of Bloody Monday. After a while, as the war slowly waned and finally ended, Bloody Monday was forgotten. A movie of the police attack, often called a police riot, The Seventh Day, was made from television news clips and won a few documentary awards. A 25th anniversary memorial of Bloody Monday was held at PSU. A replica of the hospital dome was erected at its former site. Only a few attended. Among the alumni were the former PSU president, who had previously been a CIA agent, and the sympathetic police captain, who had vainly attempted to keep the peace and save the hospital. Also, former war resistors and students who had linked arms and faced the attacking police riot squad. The same year, 1995, 20 years after the Vietnam War ended, former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara admitted the war had been, quote, terribly wrong, unquote, and that the American public was consistently deceived to justify the deaths and maiming of its young sons and many of its daughters, who were primarily military MASH nurses. Nearly 60,000 Americans were killed in Vietnam, which included medical personnel, as is currently happening in the virulently lethal coronavirus pandemic that has already killed 60,000 Americans with no plausible end in sight. Perhaps too close to 500,000 Americans were wounded in the war. A plethora of suicides by Vietnam veterans continue all these years afterward. They are not counted as war dead. McNamara's mea culpa ought to have inspired apologies from every cop, National Guardsman, politician, and armchair patriot who clubbed, tear-gassed, and maced, or arrested, or shouted traitor, and too often threatened the lives or livelihoods of Vietnam anti-war protesters. Of course, no apologies were forthcoming. A rather spectacular 50th anniversary retrospective of Bloody Monday was planned for this May 11th. It was to be sponsored by the Portland State History Department, as well as the Student Honor Society, Alumni Association, the PSU Magazine, PSU Archives, and the campus newspaper Vanguard. The Seventh Day film was to be shown with added commentary by three of the filmmakers, a video and musical profile of PSU anti-war activists by the 1969-70 yearbook photographer, a panel by former strike leaders inside a social protest. A bronze plaque commemorating the Park Box confrontation designed by the notable John Larson of Press 22 fame was slated to be unveiled. And the historical context of Bloody Monday was to be given by Dory Hilton, a professor of history and prolific jazz singer. She has written a monologue on the 1970 student strike after extensive interviews with many participants, witnesses, and bystanders. All of this, according to David Horowitz, whose tenure as PSU history professor began that same year, 1970, is being held over, as are most public gatherings in the USA this pandemic lockdown, either being canceled or delayed. Given the uncertainties of the next several months, Horowitz writes, event and plaque organizers are postponing all activities until May 2021, when we plan to stage a 50-plus-one-year commemoration. Dorie Hilton wrote in her monograph of Bloody Monday, at the cross streets in the city-owned South Park blocks that were the geographical core of the PSU campus, spontaneous collectives sprang up where students had constructed barricades to block vehicular traffic, originally for the purpose of holding rallies and demonstrations, then manned 24 hours a day. In the center of the park box, a large first aid tent was erected like a field hospital in a war zone. The park box resonated with the sights and songs of factional fighting, rallies, marches, dances, speeches, music, and eventually a violent police action that galvanized the campus community as a unit once again. And that was Dorie Hilton. A person who was certainly galvanized by the barricades community that developed in the park blocks was Arthur Honeyman, the original creator of Spastic Power. The late Arthur Honeyman, who was one of the most famous and notorious Oregonians in the state's history, would have celebrated his 80th birthday this Sunday, May 10th, the day before Bloody Monday. He died in 2008 at age 68. He was born with cerebral palsy and spent his life fighting for the rights and recognition of people who are considered physically handicapped. He was a teacher, poet, and writer who wrote several books, essays, and collections of his poetry. He was co-founder with his wife, Joanne, of Wheel Press. He had a bachelor's of science degree in history and a master of arts degree in English, both from Portland State University. He wrote of his own experience with the 1970 Portland State strike for the North Coast Times Eagle 25 years later for the May 1995 issue, titled Dubiously Involved in Important Matters. And I am going to read that now. Dubiously Involved in Important Matters by Arthur Honeyman. Bloody Monday, May 11th, 1970, was the day after my 30th birthday. Believe it or not, this factor induced me to be absent on the day that the Portland tax squad hit. The odd thing is that though I'm the type of physical coward who closes his eyes when a foam rubber ball is tossed to him, and though some of those present have repeatedly told me that I lucked out by not being there, I have always felt a sense of remorse for going home to clean and rest up. I mean, after all, what did I think it was? My birthday? I could have been a contender. My participation in the actual protest event of May 1970 was both accidental and marginal, although I definitely supported any anti-war activity. In point of fact, however, I was somewhat heavily involved in my 1970 campaign to be elected to the Oregon legislature and was focusing on the task of trying to win the upcoming May primary. It is quite possible that had my campaign manager not shamed me into it, I would have steered clear of the whole incident. If I have calculated correctly, for my usually good memory fails me here, Tuesday, May 12th, was both the day when I lost the primary and the day that just about all of Portland's liberaldom marched to City Hall and rallied in protest of Monday's brutality of the tax squad. As I recall, the Oregonian shot a photograph of me giving a garbled speech that nobody understood, but everybody applauded. The story of my insignificant participation in the PSU event goes something like this. On Friday evening, May 8th, 1970, I sat in a tavern drinking cheap Burgundy wine, Red Death it's called, by some heavy imbiber such as I was at the time, celebrating our final fling at campaigning with my manager. You should go support the strike, he said. I think all I wanted to do was get drunk, but my conscience pricked me, so I belted down my beverage, purchased a bottle, and wheeled and reeled my way down to the barricades, where I spent the next 40 hours or so thinking historical event and the like. Yes, always the self-perceived historian, even before majoring in the subject back when PSU was PSC. And always the wannabe Norman Mailer type journalist, I perused the scene with the astuteness of an alcohol befuddled military strategist. Always the romantic, this was Bastille Day almost 200 years later. Yet at the same time, I constantly questioned my sanity for remaining after my campaign manager, who had long ago left the scene, offered to get me home. To this day, I have no idea why I chose to stay as long as I did, all night Friday, all day and all night Saturday, and most of Sunday, my birthday. You see, I march to my own drummer, and there are few things that repulse me more than the thought of being blindly swept into events like sheep milling their way over a precipice of no return. But somehow I was analytically conscious that I had indeed committed myself to this course of action, and I both marveled and trembled at my epiphanous knowledge of the moment as I objectively surveyed the ludicrous makeshift barricades constructed, as it were, of overturned park benches, garbage cans, chains, street repair barriers, and anything else to obstruct easy access to the South Park blocks. Everybody knew that the barricades were symbolic and that a fortress they did not make. Nonetheless, they did block angry pro-war supporters from mowing us down with their vehicles instead of merely throwing beer bottles at us as they drove by. I may be mistaken, but I seem to recall that one such cruiser tried to ram through a barrier of benches. I could see that my presence wasn't really needed and that, like the barricades, it was merely useful as a symbol. Only to an even lesser degree, for if or when push came to shove, this cerebral palsied individual would be in the way and would be one more thing to worry about in the face of catastrophe or emergency. Thus, I took it upon myself to stay out of the way and paradoxically to wander among the strikers, the troops I stupidly romanticized, to give them moral support, or in retrospect, possibly to show how brave I was. I was fully involved now, though I was also engaging myself in a mental versus emotional balancing act. To jargonize, these were suddenly my brothers and sisters, my comrades, yet I still tried to maintain perspective. In a sense, I was being hypocritical in more ways than one. First, I was betraying what little commitment I had made toward historical accuracy and objectivity. Second, I was espousing the concept of human brotherhood and solidarity, even though I feared that too much of it might lead to fascism, as it did in Europe in the 1930s. Third, I believed in the anti-war movement, but it was not number one on my list of priorities, as I was pretending. And fourth, I was acting as though I were a college student when I had graduated 5 years before. In the final analysis, however, I told myself, as I generally do when I pursue a course of action in behalf of a cause, that action is better than inaction, no matter how futile a situation appears. One of the things I remember myself declaring whenever I was asked if I really thought protesting war would bring it to a halt went something like, "Well, no, but if we don't protest, it sure as hell won't stop." Or I would cynically sidestep the issue by snidely saying, "Peace is not peace unless it's forever, and we're not going to live that long." Needless to say, these unnecessary and laconic remarks were received in a variety of ways, as I expected, but I was sincere in my newfound belief in the value of what we were trying to achieve, nebulous though that was, so much so that the protesters became we instead of they. For once, I had joined a cause instead of creating one. In all honesty, I cannot recall getting any sleep during the 1 3/4 days in which I stayed at the scene. If I did, it was while sitting up in my walker cart, much like soldiers on horseback have done for thousands of years. What I do remember is wandering from enclave to enclave of vigilant guardians of the territory. These young protesters, some 10 years my junior, who took it upon themselves to do the dirty work outside in less than pleasant weather, while the strategists spent their nights inside the student union, openly praised me for staying with them and showed their appreciation by feeding this CP who cannot feed himself, pouring wine from the bottles into my mouth, wino that I was, and by offering me other types of drugs that didn't appeal to this Dylan Thomas type alcoholic soaked poet. Were it not for them, I question that I would have been able to hold up as long as I did. At any rate, my contribution to that incident was marginal, but his contribution to me was and is monumental. And that was Dubiously Involved in Important Matters by Arthur Honeyman. Today, May 7th, is the real VE Day. Nazi Germany surrendered its thousand-year Reich 75 years ago today. The news was given to the world the next day, May 8, 1945. So tomorrow is historically celebrated as Victory in Europe Day. World War II continued in the Pacific against Axis Japan, ending with the two nuclear mushroom clouds over the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. The nuclear age is platinum now. I end today's program with something I wrote at the beginning of what is now considered America's forever war, wartime dissent. Quite often heard lately is the admonition that dissent should be restrained and even prohibited during time of war, that it might be acceptable prior to the start of a war, but equivalent to treason once a war has started. Dissent during wartime is harshly criticized as aiding and abetting an enemy. Yet now, when even friends and neighbors disparage dissent, is the essential moment to resist, to question with intelligence and vigorous skepticism the claims of a war's necessity and righteousness, and to protest the curbing of civil liberties that seem corollary to every war. The primary purpose for dissent in wartime is to discontinue wars inimical to the principles and liberties bedrock to this nation, and to critically scrutinize every stage of a war's conduct. If there were no dissent, the government would not feel compelled to publicly explain or justify its war making, nor recognize the civil rights of combatants and citizenry, but instead issue repressive edicts disguised as necessities for the war effort. And even with dissent, government generally stonewalls in reaction to public disquiet, which imputations of treachery are unable to fully squelch. Dissent is especially important when it is realized the reasons for war are misleading or hypocritical, which begs the question, is it truly unpatriotic to condemn lies that are as surely murdering Americans as any proclaimed enemy? It makes little sense to justify the dead of a war by sending more to also die, nor is it reasonable to curb dissent to war with the rationale it would prolong a war rather than pressure its end. Dissent in wartime is a necessary antithesis to the magnification of militarism war generates. The public is governed more by military doctrines and less by civic principles. Militant dominance of government and society erodes democracy to such a point obedience rapidly supplants freedom of thought and expression as permissible patriotism. Wartime is not a time to be submissive or silent. Dissent is not a right, but an obligation for resolutely demanding veracity and integrity from self-styled war leaders and scrupulous adherence to constitutional values. And it might be argued that dissent refutes the claim that an entire society is manifestly responsible for the advent or conduct of a war and policies that lead to it. In a reframing of the concept that all members of a nation are guilty of whatever that nation does on the world scene, the liberties and freedoms within a society such as the United States dispute the contention of universal liability for total war. In that sense alone, dissent in wartime is our finest beacon. And that was something I wrote, actually, in 2004. During the Iraq War. And now, Nations revere and create hallowed landmarks out of battlefields of war. Perhaps a place where persons of peace were struck down opposing war should also be made a national memorial. Bloody Monday was 5/11, and now there has been 9/11. And I wonder if dissent against the war on terrorism and its concomitant suppression of constitutional rights and liberties might have us on the street again, eventually facing armed police and perhaps Marines and soldiers. Will they shoot us this time, like at Kent and Jackson States the week before Bloody Monday? Will they arrest us and hold us without bail? Torture us like the prisoners at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo? Will we undergo military tribunals? Will our rights to lawyers and even free trials be suspended in the name of the forever war on terrorism? And this is Michael McCusker. If you are impatient with the homebound lockdown against the plague, consider the possible alternative, and that death is forever. Protecting yourself protects everybody else. Happy VE Day. And remember Bloody Monday, which is actually on a Monday, this 50th anniversary year.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. A long ways from home. A long ways from home. Oh, my brother, a long ways from home. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone.